welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Ugin, your host. Thank you so much for joining us here on the program. We come your way Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We stream live at richarddugan.com. We also archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. And we also link to our guests' websites. We'll give you that that website address here shortly. We'll also give you contact information so that you can get in touch with our guests and get more information, follow up, maybe make contact with them and so forth. And certainly we would encourage you to do that, because what our guests have to offer, I think, is extremely important. Our guest today actually has a great deal to offer as well through his experiences and through his book, his latest work. It is called Dying to Wake Up. It is a doctor's voyage into the afterlife and the wisdom he brought back. And we want to welcome Rajiv Party to us, MD, and you actually co-wrote this with Paul Perry. And we want to thank you so much for joining us on the program today.
Oh, I'm honored to be here.
I have to say that as I was thinking about this interview, there was a line from a song that is quite familiar to me, probably not to most of the other listeners, but there's the line that says that life and death are most intimate friends. In that, I think what the author, the writer of this particular piece was saying was that there you can't have one without the other. This particular song talks about time and how we have only so much time to accomplish the things that we want, and sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. In your case, you actually left, if you will, and then you came back. And you've had that experience in that regard. I would love for you to share with us. You're a physician. You're a doctor, yeah. An MD. You have all this wonderful scientific knowledge and background. And I'm wondering how that changed your scientific view of the human being and his existence and his how do I put this? This is not a word, but I'm going to say it anyway. Animatedness, his being animated. Yeah. Okay, because for a period of time there you were not, and there are those who, as you I'm sure know, will make the allegations, accusations, or assumptions that what's really going on when people have these near-death experiences is, you know, that there are things firing in the brain and this and that and the other thing. And it's real interesting that they would make those assumptions based upon the fact that each one of us is an individual, and yet each person, though having quite somewhat similar experiences, the details for each one of them is a bit different. And that's like, well, how can that be if, you know, so forth. So tell us about your, we'll get into the story, but let me ask you about that experience and how did it change your view of being human?
You know, my I had a patient who had a similar experience many years ago. And that patient was a special kind of surgery, you know, where I specialize in being anesthesia for high-risk heart cases, cardiac cases. And the main vessel, aorta, which carries the oxygenated blood, comes off the heart, and that was damaged. Normally, we put the patient on bypass pump, so there is blood flowing through the brain, and the surgeons repair the heart. But in this particular case, we froze the patient because we could not put the patient for that particular surgery on bypass pump, and there was no blood flowing for 45 minutes to the patient's brain. And he was describing what was happening when he woke up next day, operating room, and similar, you know, out-of-body experience and going to different realms. And I thought, this guy didn't have any blood going through his brain for 45 minutes. So maybe there was some brain damage, neurological damage. So I gave him a antipsychotic shot of Haldol. And I told him I'll come back to listen to you, and I never went. That was my view before it happened to me. And when it happened to me, it changed my view about life. Like that particular patient, when he was frozen, there was no blood to brain or heart or kidneys or any organ. By all definition, he was dead. And the next day he was having breakfast with his family. You know, what is life? What is consciousness? And why are we here? And this is the very hard question, especially does the matter create consciousness, or the consciousness uses matter to manifest? This is the big question. My view is that consciousness exists independent of the matter, and it manifests through matter.
Well, I know that this has been, as long as man's been on the planet, the question as far as consciousness, what is it? Where does it reside? Is that the only element, if you will, that we carry from this realm to the next, to the next, to the next, whether you believe or not in reincarnation, or you just believe in the hereafter and other dimensions or whatever, heaven and hell? What is it that we carry with us? Do we keep the memories? What about the memories of this experience? And I know that in talking with a lot of people, and this kind of gets off into what's next, what's in the next world, and are the Christians right? Are the Muslims right? Are the Hindus right? Are the Buddhists right?
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
Mm-hmm. I said every religion has a different viewpoint.
Exactly. Yeah. But the thing about it is that the people that I speak with, especially when we talk about spirituality or we get into the metaphysical conversations, I ask the question, well, why in the world are we doing this? Why are we having these experiences? You know, what's the point? If we were with God and now we're going to be with God again, or the universal power, whatever the name you want to give, why go through this mess? And they, you know, and of course it's always, well, it's about the experiences. Which leads me to believe that, well, yes, we will take our memories with us. If that is a true construct, if you will, of passing through this dimension, if you will, of the material world. And so the consciousness isn't just the animating force, the force that also we become aware. I think, therefore, I am.
Yeah.
It's more than that. Mm-hmm. And then again, depending upon your school of thought, and sometimes it has nothing to do with that. Someone said to me the other day, in the context of an interview, I asked what is it that we're supposed to be doing here? Remembering who we are? I mean, that was the way I phrased it. He says, no. He says, we are here to remember who we have always been. And so I'm curious as to your perspective when you were in the other realm, if you will. And I'm curious. I know the only reference we can place on this is human time, the timeline. How long were you in this near-death experience away from the body?
You know, I saw myself floating near the ceiling because I remember seeing the clock in the operating room about 20 minutes after surgery. And then in the human world, I woke up in the recovery room remembering with a jolt. And when I looked at the records, I didn't have a clock in the other realms. The surgery was for two and a half hours. And, you know, these are very, very good questions you are asking. And there's even another deeper question. Like me and other people who had near-death experience, Daniel Brinkley and everybody, talk about God not feeling love, unconditional love and everything. Then is there evil? Is there hell?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why do these natural disasters happen? If God is all-powerful and kind, why can't he get rid of the evil or devil? These are questions, as you rightly pointed out, since humanity came into being.
Well, and these are questions that we get answers to, but we don't necessarily say absolutely positively, without a shadow of a doubt, you are absolutely correct. Because every person's experience is different. There are those who have had these near-death experiences. They've been dead physically in this realm for, who knows, 20, 30 minutes, an hour or more, and then they come back, and they've had horrific experiences. They've seen hell, and they become devout to whatever belief system supports that particular experience that they had, because they don't have anything else to measure it against, per se. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's what they're. And there are also those, I know of some very close friends, who are very, very concerned, Doctor, because they are afraid. I mean, there is genuine fear and concern and angst that there's nothing after they die, that it's like the lights are on and then the lights are off and there's no more existence.
Yeah.
What can you, is from your experience?
Can I give you an example?
Yes.
It was my patient I just described who was frozen.
Yes, please.
There was no blood going through the brain. Brain activity we were measuring was flatline.
Okay.
There was no blood through the heart. There was no blood anywhere. No organ was functioning. Was he dead or alive?
I'm going to say, based upon the definition that we sort of hold to, I would say he was dead. He was gone.
Mm-hmm. By modern science definition, he was dead.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we warmed him up, gave him warm blood, and, you know, through a warmer, warmed his blood up, brought him back to normal temperature, and next day he woke up.
Now, it raises an interesting question. Because in the Bible, it talks about Lazarus being raised from the dead by Jesus.
Yeah.
And yet in other passages in the same book, it states that it is appointed to man, every man wants to die, and then the judgment. Well, if that's true, then Jesus violated God's own regulations, if you will, or protocol, by bringing Lazarus back to death. Or was Lazarus really dead? And I think that's where we have the real problem, is that we don't know, and maybe we need to come up with a new term. I like to use the word transitioning. But in your case, for example, you were held, so to speak, to your body by what? A thread, that silver line or gold cord or what have you, and you made the choice to come back. Other folks, they cut the line and they don't return to the body. They go on. So we are struggling with what the definition of real death is, because I have to wonder, if Lazarus wasn't really dead, then that begs the implication that people who are having these experiences, such as yourself, including this individual who you brought back, who you froze, you reduced the body temperature to keep the blood from flowing and so forth, and the brain was flatline, mm-hmm. and yet you brought them back, either A, you are gods, okay, or B, he wasn't really dead, and that we don't really understand that concept of what death is. Do you think we need to redefine it? Do you think we need to go back and say, our modern definitions don't apply because of the things that you've talked about already?
Yeah, you know, the science, that's one place I feel science and spirituality kind of intersect. What is death? Even by scientific definition, this frozen patient was dead.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts? Do you think, and if so, how should we redefine this experience?
Yeah, you know, like, that's why in my personal life, you know, nobody has to believe my beliefs. Mm-hmm. But in my personal life, I do believe what I call now the six or seven eternal truths, which are right in my book. That is the net conclusion from my experience, that consciousness can exist outside the body. There, I met my dead father in my experience. So there is life after death. And then I met, though I'm a Hindu, I met angels, that there are divine beings who are ready to help us, you know, who have our guides, ascended masters. I saw two of my past lives. So there is also past life, which affects this life. And somebody asked me if I saw a future life. I saw my future in this life, but I didn't see a future life. And then that the nature of reality is pure love. And the next truth was that we are all connected to each other because we are like waves in the ocean, and we are made of the same consciousness. So these are my final deductions from my experience, and I'm presenting to the world, but people don't have to believe it.
Mm-hmm.
This is my conclusion from my experience, and that's what I'm going to follow. And for me, the other question was about God, evil, or devil. From a relative field where I function and live, God is there, or the divine is there. There is evil and devil, and we have to take the side of, you know, from karma point of view or religious point of view or spiritual point of view, do good things. And I really talk about prayer, service, and meditation. And service I call seva, which is a Sanskrit word for doing, caring for the other person or Mother Earth or anything higher, bigger than your own self. Bring satisfaction and joy whether you believe in God or not. But at the absolute level, there is no God and there is no devil. It is just pure consciousness. But at the relative level, there is day, there is night. You have something good because you have something bad. If there was nothing bad, there was nothing good either.
Again, the duality.
Yeah, exactly,
yeah.
Richard. You are right. As long as we are living in the duality world, where I believe I am living, there is good and bad. There is God and devil. Once you transcend duality, then there is just pure consciousness.
Now, I certainly understand what you're saying, but I want to take it to another level with you because there would be those who would argue that the duality concept is a man-made concept. And even if I was to take the I'll call them historical references in this case, because my point of reference is more Christian and would be the Bible as opposed to, say, the Bhagavad Gita or the Quran, that the devil, as he is known today, originally was an angel with God. His name was Lucifer, which means that God created Lucifer, who then made choices that got him, that had him cast out of heaven down to this specific planet, which I find interesting that it was this planet and not some other. You know, why here? Why did he have to send him here? There are billions of planets in the universe. He could have sent the devil just about anywhere. But here's where some people would say, especially from a different, say, metaphysical or spiritual perspective. There is no good and evil, right and wrong, good and bad. It all just is. And that it is a human mental construct, just like time is. And that if we were able to learn to separate ourselves from that, instead of looking at the flowers blooming as beautiful and good, they just are. That just is. And we look at the horrific events around the world of man's inhumanity to man, not as evil, they just are. It's just, those are just the elements that make up this world. And that, I mean, that's where some folks are beginning to get to, because I think that it could be, and I'd love your perspective on this. It may be a defense mechanism on their part because they're tired of dealing with and struggling with. I know that many people, especially in this country, having gone through the political circus that we went through in 2016, they're really tired of the struggle. People are tired of living from paycheck to paycheck and just surviving. They want to thrive. Mm-hmm. They really want to feel the abundance of life and living and experiencing, you know, and so they might latch on to this construct of, you know, everything just is, you know, it's not good or bad. Hitler wasn't good or bad. Jesus wasn't good or bad. Buddha wasn't good or bad. Genghis Khan wasn't good or bad. Hurricane Katrina and the earthquake in Italy.
Stalin and everybody.
Yeah, exactly. It just is. It just is. What are your thoughts on something like that?
You know, Richard, to be honest with you, I'm really enjoying talking to you. You know, I've given almost two interviews every day for the last 1 week, but I never went this deep. You know, my thought on this is, it depends upon your own evolution of consciousness, where you're looking at. As if you're going beyond duality, then it is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
For me personally, there are consequences for action. That's the way we should act. Like, my mother's love for me is unconditional. No matter what I do, she will love me. But I live in the society. If you go and kill somebody, there are going to be consequences.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there are people who had near-death experience, and they say there is no judgment and everybody goes to heaven. So no matter what you do in this world, you will go to heaven and have a great, wonderful, very pleasurable life. And same way, if you look at the other religions, like the people who bombed the World Trade Center, they were going to get the virgins in heaven. So, you know, these are very difficult questions to answer. I think we all have to come to our own beliefs. From our experience as a child, as our spiritual experience. And one thing which is very universal, and I call it the religion for the 21st century, is being connected to something higher, which is not necessarily God. Higher ideal, as I said, to serve fellow humanity, to serve animals, to serve earth. If you don't believe in God, to be for against child pornography or women abuse or anything which touches your heart. And the modern science of positive psychology and happiness agrees with that. Fulfillment only comes from being connected to something bigger than your own small ego.
Mm.
And that bigger is for everyone to define on their own.
Yeah, and I think that's an extremely important point. I worked for 15 years back in the 80s and 90s for a Christian radio station, and I had to go through my own process of getting to that point and allowing people to have the experiences that they had. And I actually did get to the point where I would also share with people that if you had an experience such as yours, Rajiv, in terms of a near-death experience, who am I, and with what arrogance do I have the right to say, no, I'm sorry, it doesn't say that in the book, whatever the book is that I happen to be following, and you did not have that experience. That is contrary to the doctrine and dogma, okay? I've gotten to the point over the last 30, 40 years of saying, if that's your experience, who am I to argue? Tell me more. I'm very curious. As a matter of fact, some of the elements that you discuss, you have seven basic truths that were revealed to you. Consciousness exists outside the body, which you've referred to. There is life after death. We have past lives, and our experiences therein can shape our current realities. We are all connected to each other because we are all made of the one and same energy that manifests as differential matter. Divine beings exist to help and guide us. There are different levels of consciousness, and there is one all-pervading supreme love and intelligence that is the source of the entire universe, and that love is the supreme source of creation. And I have a feeling that, Rajiv, you would add at the end of that, and that's what I believe.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Richard, you're 100% correct. That's what I believe. I'm presenting it to you.
Yeah.
You believe it or you don't believe it. It's your life experience and your choice. You know, there are a lot of Hindus who don't believe in reincarnation. You know, in general, Hindus do.
Yeah.
There are exceptions. There are... they are called in India rationalists, you know, who say all this prayer, mantra, and it's all bogus.
Well, I think the same thing can be said within Christianity or any other religion, that not everybody believes the same things. And actually, I've had some great experiences specifically, obviously, with Christianity and various Christians that I've come to know. And I'm always greatly surprised by their openness in sort of private moments as we converse about the things that they believe that aren't part of the doctrine and dogma of that belief system that they say they are connected to or that they espouse to. And I find that, honestly, I find that very refreshing. I mean, I've interviewed on this program a fundamentalist evangelical Christian who practices out-of-body experiences.
Yeah. Like, I have a very good Christian friend, a colleague. He's a Christian, but he does believe in law of karma and reincarnation.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
He's a Catholic. And for me, I literally, since my experience, I literally believe in angels. And my favorite angel right now is Angel Gabriel. I, in my wildest dream, never thought I'll be publishing a book and it'll become an Amazon bestseller on the first day. I'll get so many interviews. I just came back day before yesterday from New York. Fox and Friends invited me on their main show in New York. You know, all these things that are happening, you know, at least for me, Angel Gabriel is helping me. He or she, some people call he, some people call she, is the angel for communication, for speaking and writing. And I saw this in my near-death experience. You know, like I say, you know, like I, as an anesthesiologist, used to put people to sleep, but now I wake them up.
Hmm. I think that people need to read your story. They can do just that. All they have to do is go to your website, which is Dr. Rajiv Partee, and that's a DR.
And actually, the easiest website to go to is just the book now, dyingtowakeup.com.
Oh, there you go. All right. Then that's an additional. We'll link to that, dyingtowakeup.com. Easy enough, folks. It is a doctor's voyage to the afterlife. And the wisdom he brought back, we're going to talk more about that wisdom, as well as some of the folks that he came in contact with on the other side. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, and I want you to stay right where you are. There's more to come.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
And welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We've been talking with Dr. Rajiv Partee, and he has written a book, an extraordinary work that describes his experience and near-death experience. He's also a consultant in consciousness-based healing. We're going to talk about that as well. And of course, the book is Dying to Wake Up, and we certainly encourage you to pick up the book, as well as go to the website, dyingtowakeup.com. Now, you went to a number of different places through your near-death experience. You did go to what you experienced and what you refer to as hell. Is that correct?
That is correct.
But you also went other places, and you also met with other family members, other relatives, your father in particular. Tell me about the relationship with your father prior to his passing, and then counter that with the experience that you had of him and with him in the near-death experience.
Yeah, you know, I was the only son, the eldest son, and I had a very difficult relationship with my father. You know, he was product of partition of India, you know, when India and Pakistan got divided.
Oh, yes.
One being Hindu and one being Muslim, and my family was stuck on the Pakistan side of border. And literally, there was genocide on both sides. Hindus killing Muslims, Muslims killing Hindus who were stuck on the wrong side of the border. So my father was around 18, came from Pakistan to India, hiding among dead bodies. And for 2 years, his mother didn't know whether he was alive or dead. They got separated. So my father used to sleep on the street, basically on newspaper, had to struggle a lot. So I feel now, as a doctor, that he suffered from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. He was angry, very short-tempered, you know, frustrated, and he took it out on me. But in my near-death experience, when I was being pushed into hell, and I was asking for help and kind of repenting, yeah, I had been a mean person. I had been egoistic, not caring for my patient. I was technically a very good doctor, but being an anesthesiologist, but I was not connecting to my patients, you know, at the empathy level. He came to my rescue, and I realized that after all, he did love me. He did care for me, but he could not express it. So a big part of my message is forgiveness. And forgiveness, I talk about not for their sake, but for your own sake. Because if you have emotions attached to it, a charge attached to it, you are the one who's suffering. The other person who caused forgiveness is maybe having a good time in Hawaii. So you're forgiving that person, but not condoning the action, not making the wrong action right for your own sake. And forgiveness I talk about at four levels. One is forgiving people who have harmed you. Second is asking for forgiveness from people you may have harmed. Third is to forgive yourself for harming your own self, which is, I find, the hardest. And the fourth being forgiving yourself for harming others. And I do workshop. In my workshop, I take people through forgiveness exercise. And it's not a one-time deal. Like, I wrote letters to myself, to my father, and even God. I was mad at God, and I burnt the letters. But it was an exercise. You have to repeat it again. And gradually, the emotions, the charge with that goes down and brings more peace and fulfillment. So forgiveness is a big thing I learned from my near-death experience. And my ultimate thing is that you don't have to have a near-death experience to transform. The transformation is available to you right now. And three main things are prayer, service, and meditation. Like, prayer is when you talk to God, and meditation is when God talks to you.
Hmm. But Rajiv, forgiveness, but I already forgave them once before. Why do I need to keep forgiving?
Because if they bring up emotional charge, for some people forgiving once could work, but for some people it may not work, because sometimes I remember, you know, like I was 66, 67, I was 9, 10 years old, and my father's younger brother had come from America. I was living in New Delhi, India, and he brought a Parker pen, and I lost that Parker pen. And I got such a bad beating, that until recently, you know, I used to get very charged up thinking of that. So, you know, like, it takes a long time to forgive people. Not one suffer. It may work for some people, I'm not saying that.
Mm-hmm.
But it depends upon the depth of the trauma and of what age and what happened. And your own spiritual beliefs.
Right. So just as you talk about prayer, service, and meditation, the forgiveness, I would think, would come more under the category of prayer in that respect. But what about the aspect of forgiving self? Is that the focal point, or are we also talking about forgiving others for what they've done to us? Because I've heard it actually said that we don't need to forgive anybody else but ourselves because of weight that we carry.
I believe that forgiving oneself is one of the hardest forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
It is.
Yeah.
Like, why did I do this? Why did I not think right? What was I thinking? Why did I, do this something wrong? Why did I cheat? Why did I get addicted? You know, why did I start drinking? And, you know, this why, you know, kills you.
Yeah. I know that for a lot of folks, that's a big struggle to go through that process of forgiveness. They've been carrying stuff around for so long, and then there are also those who say, "Well, I didn't do anything wrong. Why do I need to forgive them or myself? I did." You know, they're standing in that, shall we say, that prideful or arrogant position of self-righteousness, if you will. And maybe they're right. I don't know, but. It's almost like, well, what do you have to lose by forgiving? And is there, have you found, did you discover in your, I'll call it your journey, your near-death experience, your journey, did you find a particular, because human beings and their brains work this way, a particular method of effective forgiveness? And again, acknowledging the fact that it's not a one-time deal. It's ongoing. But can you share with us if there is a particular a way?
You know, like I believe, you know, in this two or three things. One, as I said, writing letters, but not mailing it even if the person is alive. And as if you're talking to that person's higher self. And the other thing is, you know, to invite in your heart chakra or, you know, the heart center, that person and yourself. You know, first you bring in the person like compassion, you know, like who you know has compassion for you. Like I do this exercise. I have a very good relationship with my mother, but not everybody may have it. I bring in my mother. So it kind of presets my body chemistry. You know, body chemicals change. And then you bring in a neutral person, and then you replace that neutral person with a, you know, the person you really need to forgive. The big part of this is that the body remembers. Body has its own memory. We think that the memory is stored just in the brain, but the body also remembers. So to bringing it to the heart, and then going through the process of forgiving. So you associate the good feelings which started with your mother and the same feelings then to a neutral person and then to the person you're trying to forgive. So compassion and forgiveness kind of go hand in hand.
Mm. Well, it's something certainly that we all need to learn, we need to use, we need to bring into our lives just because that, as I have experienced as well as have discussed on this program, it's like as we go through our lives, this was the analogy that there's this thin mylar or plastic coating over our lives. And as we poke, as we do things that are not quite appropriate, you know, we might cross a line here and there. We poke holes in that. Or somebody does us a wrong. A hole is poked through from the other side. Mm-hmm. Forgiveness sort of repairs those little holes in that mylar or plastic covering. It's kind of a strange analogy, but nonetheless.
But it's beautiful, yeah. I may use it, yeah.
You know,
and actually, I recommend people, when they're closing their eyes, like my close at bedtime,
mm-hmm.
to forgive people who harmed you, just takes 1 or 2 minutes, and to forgive people who harmed you, and then ask for forgiveness you harmed, and forgiving yourself for anything you hurt yourself or others.
Yeah.
Takes 1 minute. So you start every day without any baggage.
Yeah. And that's extremely important. As a matter of fact, as a kid growing up and even into my teens, and I would be walking around through the malls and different places like that, and I would see a lot of the older folks, and we're talking about in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, and especially the men, I would see many who were walking with canes, which was fine, but they were hunched over. Almost mm-hmm. to the point where they couldn't even raise their head up to look. It was as if they were looking for something on the ground all the time.
Yeah.
And my first thought was, what kind of weight are they still carrying at this age that they haven't let go of? And I think that's what we do, is as we go through our lives and we don't forgive others and we don't forgive ourselves, we add a little pebble. And another one, and another one, and another one to a weight that's around our necks that's pulling our heads down,
wow.
almost in a sense of shame.
Yeah. You're right. So that's why, you know, my things are, you know, more secular than any particular religion, mm-hmm. you know. When I say divine beings, it could be Jesus, it could be Krishna, it could be Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's up to your choice.
Yeah.
Or Zoroaster, or, you know, any of other highly evolved spiritual beings.
Now, I ordinarily would say, okay, let's go to the next one, a service. I think that's pretty self-explanatory, and we may jump back to it, but I want to jump to meditation, because I know that within specifically Hinduism, but also other cultures as well, other philosophies, meditation is a very big part of the life of that particular devotee or renunciant, if you will. And I'm curious as to your perspective on meditation. Obviously, it's important because it's one of the three pillars, if you will, of what we're talking about. Talk to us about your understanding and your perspective on meditation.
You know, I feel meditation is the fourth level of consciousness, the other three being sleep, dreaming, and awake, we all are familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And meditation is, to define it, it would be very focused attention. And there are different kinds of meditation people call mindful, mindless meditation, mantra-based, breath-based, or focusing on a particular deity. And basically, it elevates the level of consciousness. And I have come to the conclusion that Albert Einstein was right in saying that a solution to a problem cannot be found at the level it was created. So, for example, if somebody is a smoker or a drinker, like one of the famous Indian who came to U.S. was Maharishi, who brought TM. He never told people to stop smoking or drinking, but he encouraged them to do meditation, which I personally do twice a day, and was to elevate the level of consciousness. And when you elevate the level of consciousness, the things which are not serving you just automatically fall off. So you don't have to use your super will to change.
I have to say that, again, in different philosophies, there are different ways of meditating. And I have to say that, going back to prayer for a moment, that I think I would make a very terrible Muslim, because I don't think that I could take five times out of my five spots during my day to stop and pray. That I kind of lean towards, I think, what Teresa of Avila once said, that God lives among the pots and the pans. I don't need to stop doing what I'm doing. I just need to honor God wherever I am, whatever I'm doing.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, like a doctor who is seeing his patient with kindness and care is practicing a fine kind of prayer and meditation. He doesn't have to prayer and meditation just does not happen in church. You can do it while seeing patients. And you can literally remember God if you have a particular deity. You know, it's all come to individual level, what you wants to believe in. Like I keep repeating a mantra almost all the time.
And that's something, too, that we can find that kind of phrase. There are certain passages. There have been people on this program who've written certain books that they will lay out a set of passages, a set of phrases that have worked for them, and which is wonderful. And they might work for me. We all hope that what we're doing here in sharing these concepts and ideas that have worked for you, for example, in this case, Rajiv, work for me, work for other people. But there's no guarantee. And that's why we encourage people to continue to follow through. Go to dyingtowakeup.com. Check out the book. Check out the information that Rajiv has shared with us here on the program to see if it resonates with you, to see if it fits into your life and your lifestyle and your philosophy. It doesn't have to fit completely. Take bits and pieces. Again, this is a smorgasbord. You come to the table and you eat what you want. You don't have to eat everything, just what you want, what works for you, what fits for you, what serves you. And as you just said, I think very appropriately so, Rajiv, especially through meditation, the other things start to drop away, the things that don't serve us. I think that's one of the problems that we do have in our society here in the West, though, is we have trouble letting go of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, affirmations work a lot, too. Like, I repeat, you know, I learned it from Buddhist metatic heart techniques. May I be peaceful. May I be happy. May I be healthy. You know,
mm-hmm.
You don't have to say to somebody outside. You can say to yourself, may I be happy. May I be peaceful. May everybody be happy. May everybody be peaceful, you know, including me.
I always found that rather interesting myself, that there are those who, for whatever reason, want to keep it off to themselves. And it's not something that you should or that you even can keep to yourself, that it's available to all of us right
exactly.
Now where we are.
Yeah. You don't have to die. You have to transform.
Folks, did you hear that? Say that one more time.
You don't have to die to transform. The transformation is available to you right now. Now is the time.
Yeah.
Don't postpone it.
When you go out and talk to people, and in conferences or workshops or what have you, about your experiences that happened now 6 or 7 years ago, and ironically, it happened on Christmas Day. Do you find people who are a little bit in awe of you and your experience, that something so miraculous has happened to you? They don't think that, and again, we're not talking about the near-death experience here, folks. We're talking about the transformation. That they think they have to go through the same experiences you had, and if they don't, they're less than. Do you run into people like that you sort of have to work with?
Yeah, I meet people from all backgrounds with all different views, you know, like it is hypoxia, or it is DMT, or it is God molecule, or just a dying brain, or, you know, like from different views. That's one thing. It is my experience, and you don't have to believe every part of it, and whichever, like some people may just be, the concept of service may suit them better than prayer, because prayer somehow you're praying to an external being, you know, especially, you know, if you believe that it's like a father, like a strict father, you know. So that's why I meet different people, and you can take what you believe. But universal view I have is of forgiveness, love, which is kind of service, and healing. Forgive, love, and heal.
You know, I have an upcoming interview with a gentleman who became a Buddhist monk. He took vows, and he then shared with me in a text. He apologized actually for not sharing with me that he had just recently given up those vows, and thought that because he had done that, that maybe he wasn't worthy of doing the interview that we have planned coming up here in a couple of weeks. And my thought was, my gosh, it makes it even more relevant. And
yeah,
that
both
he,
sides of the story, yeah.
Right. And he found, obviously, we're going to find out more in a couple of weeks. We're going to have him on the program. He found out that being a Buddhist monk and being under those vows, as it were, having taken those vows, was something that made him less than. And I thought that that was really, really, you know, kind of extraordinary that, and I can understand that, but I, like I said, I find it, fascinating, again, that he felt that way. And actually, you know, when we go through these experiences, such as what you've been through, near-death
yeah.
experience, and you've seen your father, and you've been to different places and what have you. Is this an experience that you preferably not through a life-threatening event in your physical body, that if you could induce it, would you? If you could do out-of-body experience, that type of thing, would you? Or have you basically, you have gleaned all you need to and want to, and enough for the rest of your lifetime, you don't need to have that again to reinforce?
You know, somebody asked, you know, guru has almost become a negative word, but, you know, somebody asked a spiritual master, you're already a master, why do you continue to pray and meditate? And he replied, to remain a master. And so I would not say that I want to duplicate that experience, and there's no way of doing it. The closest specialty which is capable of doing it is anesthesiology, because we literally take people half dead. But my experience, I think I need to continue to make it grow with continuous practice. It's just like a living plant.
Mm-hmm.
You have to give it sun, water, and the nutrients. Similarly, for the light or the flame of God or spirit to keep lighted within our heart, I need to tend to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I continue to meditate. I continue to pray. And I do so. Get visions of angels and dreams, or my father visits me in dreams. And like, I have a beautiful relationship with my father right now. If I have to go for an interview where I'm nervous or whatever, I wear his shirt. So I have to have his blessings with me, and it has never failed me.
Hmm. Now, I'm curious.
So that's my belief. It's not that you start wearing your father's shirt and it doesn't work, you know.
Now, I'm just out of curiosity. Are you wearing that shirt today?
No. I'm not right now.
Okay. Well, I think that, I can relate to that. And I was a kid growing up, and I remember my dad used to wear this light windbreaker to work on days when it was actually cold in Phoenix, Arizona. And he would come home, and it would smell of printer's ink. And I remember wanting that jacket for years. Of course, I was too small at the time, but I finally grew sufficiently to where I was actually given that jacket. And it was a source of great pride for me. Nobody else knew, but I did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I loved wearing that jacket. I've had, of course, the distinct privilege, I say honor and privilege, of actually interviewing my parents on this program.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow.
And it is not a program that has been aired on the radio, nor is it available to the public at my parents' request, but it is available to family. They have the link to the interview. And to special people who I might pass it on to with that disclosure that, you know, it not be publicized. But it was a wonderful experience. And I see my parents less as parents and more as friends, very good friends, very spiritual friends. And it sounds to me like you have transcended that as well. I'm curious about your relationship with your mother.
Yeah, me and my mother are very close. And we share the same birthday, 11th August. And when my father was physically abusive to me, she came to my rescue all the time. Sometimes even physically defended me. I'm very thankful for my mother. It's a wonderful relationship.
Mm.
You know, I wish I was there, you know, taking care of her. I brought her to America a few times, but then she gets bored, so...
Nothing to do?
Yeah.
Well, I suppose I can understand that. Yeah, okay. I find that rather humorous in that there is so much to do here, but not for her.
Yeah, you can be lonely in a crowd.
That's exactly right. I have trouble, and it's interesting, as I've gotten older. Now, when I was a kid growing up and even into my teens and 20s, I loved going to malls during the holidays and weaving my way in and out of the crowds. I don't know, some reason it was like, what a challenge. It was sort of a slalom, and I wasn't bouncing off of people or anything. It was when there was an opening, when the seas parted, I went through.
Yeah.
Today, I don't like people walking in front of me or behind me because I just don't know what they're going to do. I still have to, I don't mind so much to the side, although there's still the same issue, but I don't like people following me. I don't like people looking over my shoulder when I work. I don't know if that's due to age or just, I'm not sure where that comes from. I may have to do my own psychotherapy in that regard.
Yeah.
But you're right. And I can do without some of the crowd events. Now I might go into a crowd rather quickly and do my business and come out. But in terms of spending a great deal of time, now we go to theater, we'll go to the movies, we'll do those kinds of things. And sometimes the theaters are full, different kind of thing. But it's those moving crowds, like at concerts or at fairs or things like that. But in terms of our family, now you say you were the eldest, the only male, the only son, correct?
Yeah, and I have two younger sisters.
And how about your relationship with them, especially after this experience?
You know, with my sisters, I had a good relationship, but at the same time, they were a little jealous of me because my mother used to favor me, you know, and like I was on my mother's pet. But since this experience and since we became adults, they have become my very close friends and confidants. And, you know, my relationship, other relationships totally changed. Especially the relationship with my elder son, because I kind of forced him to go into medical school, and then after going for a few years, he dropped out. I was normally very mad, angry, and all the money wasted. So my near-death experience literally repaired generational habit. You know, my grandfather was abused by his father, and my grandfather abused, you know, physically my father, and I was not physically abusive to my children, especially my elder son, but verbally I was, you know, put him down. So spiritual growth or spiritual experiences change your family history. So trauma can happen, in my view, at four levels. Trauma can be a residual from your past life, could be left over from your childhood, or some people even call the womb, in the womb. And third would be your trauma from life now or as an adult. And fourth trauma is what is nowadays called family constellations, like something which your grandfather suffered, like people who had Holocaust victims, their grandchildren, though they were not part of Holocaust, they are suffering those consequences. So trauma can be at four sources rather than levels. Sources, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there's I think it's an Old Testament passage talking about, in this case, this is not what you're referring to, but I'm just kind of using this as the base, that the sins of the father is passed down to the sons and to down seven generations. And I'm wondering if the traumas of the father, and in this case, just that generation, the trauma is passed down to the next generation.
Modern science says three generations, three or four,
Yeah.
You know, try to correlate it with epigenetics.
Mm-hmm. I really want to thank you so much for sharing your time with us. And also, should you find yourself here in Southern California, here in Santa Barbara, we would love...
Yeah, I am in, I have a condo in downtown LA where my daughter lives. She's going to University of Southern California to become a dentist like her mom.
Mm-hmm.
And my main house is in Bakersfield, which is only 2 hours away.
Well, we would love to have you in studio to continue this conversation.
I loved it, Richard, talking to you, you know. And, you know, we both come from different backgrounds. You know, what I believe, you know, like one of the Indian saints said, you know, God or spirit is like blind men trying to describe an elephant. Somebody who touches the trunk gives a different description. Somebody who touches the tail gives a different description of divine. Or somebody touches the big leg gives a different, God is like a tree trunk. Because by definition, this is again my personal view, that we are limited, finite beings. And God, by definition, is infinite, so it's not fully comprehensible to us.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I'd like to do is I've got three final questions for you before we wrap up the program. And I thank you so much for taking so much time, and we won't keep you beyond the deadline that you have. The first of the three is, who is Rajiv Party?
You know, like what I believe Rajiv Party is my label for this life, and he's a spiritual being having a human experience. And evolution of consciousness is the main purpose of life. So we all are spiritual beings having a human experience.
Mm-hmm. All right. And what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Beautiful question. My mission in life is to help people who are suffering from pain and especially addictions through prayers, different kind of service and meditation to evolve and be cured, what I call them as diseases of the soul.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
My life purpose is to act. There are different roles I'm playing, to be the best husband I can be, to be a good to my children, and help the society grow to be a more peaceful, humane society. And knowing the fact that good and bad will both exist at the same time, and evolve myself.
Again, I want to thank you so much for sharing so much time with us here on the program. And we encourage our listeners to go to dyingtowakeup.com, where they can get a copy of the book. That's also available through amazon.com. So we encourage you to check out both locations, get more information. And again, hopefully one day we will see you here in studio across the table, and we'll have a continuation of this conversation. I've really enjoyed this.
I really enjoyed it, Richard.
And again, thank you so much. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. One more time, thank you so much, Dr. Rajiv Partee, for joining us here on the program and for your book and your story about your life, your near-death experience in Dying to Wake Up. Again, thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, love to Lal.